Good morning. Buenos días. I'm so happy to see you folks out there, because when I got here, there was only two people here. So it shows how dedicated you are. Anyway, let me get started, and that's the theme of my presentation. Cultural and Linguistic Competency Resource Center to facilitate the elimination of health disparities. I have no vested interests out there with that 1% of America. All right. Overview. So these are some themes that I'm going to talk about this morning. And first of all, Megan did a fantastic job. So she kind of set the stage for me. So I'll talk about cultural competence, our Office of Minority Health, and the national standards that we're in the process of updating, and then talk about the OMH thing, cultural health, I guess, website or a resource center that we have that I think has been received very well by you folks out there in Ground Zero, right? All right. Health disparities. I don't need to really go into detail about that, because I think most of us in this room understand how disparities disproportionately affect minority communities. But these are just some, I guess, snapshots of some of the disparities that affect minority communities. You think about, for example, hospitalizations that are preventable, and especially for minority populations, we're spending almost $7 billion a year. I mean, and so we're talking about reducing the deficit. I mean, here's an opportunity where we can, do something about that. It's not that we don't have the money; it's there. All right, and then you look at HIV rates for African Americans. It continues to go high. For Latinos and other minorities, it's starting to increase. And obviously, those disparities have major kind of budgetary consequences on all communities, not only the minority communities, but the general community in general. And it's costing us. I mean, not only costing us money, but it's having a severe impact on the well-being of those individuals affected by HIV, but also even the family in general. And then teen pregnancy. I mean, that's starting to become more of a problem, especially among Latina women. And it's always been a problem with African American teens, even though I heard that it's kind of, stabilized. But that continues to be a big issue. And so we have babies having babies, right? I mean, that's a big problem. Okay. So what is cultural competence? What is cultural and linguistic competence? I think Megan gave a great kind of definition, bless you, in terms of, the definition that she's using. But I also see it almost like a civil rights kind of issue, that we look at individuals or accept individuals as who they are, regardless of color, race, or national creed, regardless of whether they speak another language other than English. We recognize that every individual has a different kind of perspective in terms of how they view health. Okay, how do they view well-being? And I think clinicians need to understand that and not take just a Western kind of perspective and kind of say, this is the way things work here, and this is the way it should be done. But, be open-minded. We all have a different view of the world, and we all have a different view of reality. And I think practitioners need to understand that those patients come with different kind of perspectives in terms of the healthcare system in general. Some don't even, some who are recent immigrants, I mean, didn't come from a healthcare system or never were provided healthcare. And then they come over here and all of a sudden it's a complex system. Even us, for us educated folks, it's a maze. So basically I think if we can just look at how we look at culture, everybody has a culture, regardless of black, white, blue, yellow, whatever. We all have different cultures. And we just have to appreciate those differences and cultural kind of attributes. Okay. So why is cultural and linguistic competency so important? Well, I see cultural competency service delivery as a means or as another tool to fight the battle in reducing health disparities. Right? It's almost when you go to war, right? And I had to use war analogies, but you know, when you go to war, you use different strategies, different tactics, different weapons, right? And so, to me, using cultural competency is just one tool of many that we can use to reduce health disparities, right? The Megan had a perfect slide when she talked about reducing errors, right? Also, there's better adherence to certain treatments, approaches, because let's say a patient sees a provider that mirrors he or her, right? And there's that instant rapport with that provider. If that provider looks like that patient, or even if that provider doesn't look like that patient, but understands the language or the cultural background of that patient, that if that provider is able to communicate with that patient, in Spanish or another language, I mean, you're already breaking down a barrier right there in terms of establishing some kind of trust and rapport with that patient. And that's so crucial, I think, for you clinicians in the room in terms of that. If you gain that trust, then that's a win already. We know that literature is starting to show that if you do provide culturally competent care, it does facilitate, better health outcomes. We're not there yet in terms of the concrete evidence, but I think we're getting there. There's studies that are coming out about the business case, which is true if you look at the private managed care organizations. What are they doing? They're hiring folks that represent the community. They're developing marketing kind of materials that resonate with the communities that they want to reach. They use the ethnic media to do outreach because they understand that that's a market that they want to penetrate. They understand that there's, profit in serving a more diverse kind of patient caseload. And then lastly, we all understand there are legislative kind of mandates that we want to meet. Title VI of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. We have the Joint Commission Accreditation, which is really pushing cultural competency kind of standards into their surveys. And then you have NCQF, the National, Forum for, I forgot, Quality or something. They're developing cultural competency measures, and the announcement just went out, I think, a couple of weeks ago. So that's one of the reasons, that we're pushing the importance of cultural competency service delivery. Just one more thing. I want to go back a little bit. You think about culture, right? It's right here, right now, right there. That individual right there who is hearing impaired and someone is using sign language. In the deaf community, there's a culture. All right? So and that's a good example in terms of cultural competency right there. Breaking down communication barriers. Okay. All right. Now, this map just gives you an idea in terms of the cultural competency legislation that's going on right now. For example, California has passed cultural competency legislation. The state of Washington, state of New Mexico, New Jersey. I think New Jersey passed landmark legislation making it a requirement for physicians to be, in order to be licensed, they had to pass some cultural competency training. And the state of Connecticut is another state that recently passed legislation in reference to cultural competency requirements. So there is a movement, but I can tell you that it's going to be even more difficult now because of the deficits that every state is confronting. But I think there is a movement. It's almost like you think about the book, Tipping Point, you know. I think we're getting there, and it's starting to stick. Oops. Sorry here. All right. So I work, as was indicated earlier in the introduction, I work for the Office of Minority Health. And obviously our mission is what? To develop policies and initiatives to help reduce health disparities in minority populations. But one of the major agenda items is cultural competency, pushing that agenda. And when I came on board, one of the first tasks that my boss gave me was, we've been, legislatively mandated to develop a center to address language barriers of diverse populations. So we said, I want you to develop the center. So I came up with this name. I mean, obviously with some dialogue with some of my colleagues, it's called the Center for Linguistic and Cultural Competence in Healthcare. It's called a CLIC. People think, oh, Guadalupe, you have a big center, so you have a lot of money. No. And you have a big staff? No, it's just me. But my boss, the power of one, right? My boss, who was a visionary, he was able to allocate some monies to the center. And he said, go out and develop some, you know, projects that you think will have an impact in the community, in the healthcare community. And so that if we do get called up at Congress, we can tell them we were proactive, right? That we did this. And so one of the major projects that we developed was the National Standards for Culturally and Linguistically Appropriate Services in Healthcare called CLASS. And basically, the CLASS standards provide a framework for providing culturally and linguistically appropriate services to diverse populations. And it's a set of mandates, guidelines, and recommendations. And later I'll talk a little bit about what we're trying to do to enhance the standards. So they're basically broken up with three themes, culturally competent care, language access services, and organizational supports. Okay, so I just want to go back a little bit. So on language access services, I just want to give you a figure. 55.4 million Americans speak another language other than English. And that's not going to decrease. It's going to continue to increase. I was at a presentation a couple of days ago at APHA, and the presenter said something about, you know, too bad we don't think like the Europeans, because in Europe they promote the acquisition of more than one language, and over here we're promoting what, English only. You know, it doesn't make any sense, right? I have three kids. They're no longer kids, right? But, two boys and a girl, and they all speak Spanish. My daughter speaks, she spent time in Brazil, and now she speaks Portuguese. And, you know, it's an asset, you know. And I always tell my colleagues, if they have kids, when they're growing, send them to a bilingual school. Push your kids to learn another language. I mean, you have to. We live now in a global community, and it's so important that the future generation acquire another language. Okay. So we're now in the process of enhancing the CLASS standards. They're 11 years old, and we've learned a lot during that span of time. Megan's organization has done phenomenal work, in terms of pushing, the CLASS standards and other kind of concepts. You know, it's fantastic what they're doing. We have almost 11-year experience, and we want to. There's a lot of things going on right now. The ACA, right? The Affordable Care Act. There's the NCQA. Everybody's on board now. The Joint Commission. So we want to make sure that as we go through this process, we capture all the good work that's being out there. And that we're on parallel tracks, so we're congruent basically, right? Because we want to support each other. Oh my goodness, 2 minutes. All right, real quick. We went through a developmental process. We had a public comment period. We held hearings in San Francisco, Chicago, and Baltimore. We posted on the web, I think, for about 90 days. And we did an environmental scan in terms of what's out there, legislation, new projects, new initiatives in reference to class. We hope to finish and release the new revisions by either late December of this year or early January of 2012. The Affordable Care Act, real quickly, there's about 12 citations in the ACA that cites cultural competence. So we're using that as leverage. Obviously, we want to keep building the evidence to promote this kind of work. Hold on. And then lastly, I want to talk about maybe 30 seconds, but the Think Cultural Health, it's a website. It's basically a website clearinghouse, and that's the website domain name. It's www.thinkculturalhealth.hhsgov. We have a number of continuing education kind of programs for health professionals. We've got them for physicians, nurses, emergency responders, and also we're developing one for oral health professionals. Obviously, we want to increase the competency skills of practitioners right now, because we're not there. In terms of minority representation, we're not there, and at least we need to train the existing workforce. I encourage you to join the CLIC. It's a free e-newsletter, and we have a number of other resources on that website. All these programs, like I said, are offered 24/7, fully accredited for CME and continuing education. That's it. I'm sorry. But I'm available for questions at the end. We have conducted evaluation on these programs, and I can answer questions at the end. Sorry.